Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Armistice Day show. That was the name of Veterans Day before it became Veterans Day. It started after World War I, and I thought it would be a good time to celebrate. Well, I won't say celebrate. Let's say remember that. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. Rick Phillips is on assignment in Isomville, but with me from the University of Kentucky to carry the show in his absence, assistant professor with the Physician Assistant Program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
Our show is lodged comfortably on the internet at WMKY.org. You can look under the Health Matters icon. But before you do that, take a look around their webpage. There are a lot of other good shows recorded there. I actually do that pretty regularly because I miss the Reader's Notebook, and you can pick up previous versions of that on the WMKY.org page. You can listen to our show. You can slow it down. You can try to figure out exactly how bad it is and where we went wrong. After you're armed with that information, then head over to Facebook, HM Radio Show, and look for and give us some feedback. Tell us what your research has uncovered as to why this show has been noticeably unsuccessful. Also, give us topics or just simply take a look at the things that we put there, everything from unusual cases. See, we did the two magnets in the nose case is on there, as well as some interesting things that the drug companies are doing to us or that our healthcare system is trying to accomplish. After you finish that, then it's time just to settle back and wait for next week, and we're sorry about that, but it is now next week, so we're going to go ahead with the show. Our sponsor, Vaccination League. Don't be late. Vaccinate. Avoid harsh chemical vitamins and antibiotics. Vaccination like Mother Nature with a 23-gauge needle, and it is November 11. You are in those last few days when you can get vaccinated and still have some semblance of immunity.
Don't sugarcoat it. They're late.
Well, I'm looking at Thanksgiving. I am reminding myself that we traditionally have an uptick in influenza during and after the Thanksgiving holidays. And you, my friends, November 11th, are about to miss the opportunity to protect yourself from that Thanksgiving outbreak. It is just around the corner. It really is. If you have put it off and put it off and put it off, let's just make our resolution to get your flu shot done. There's so many ways you can get this done. There are drive-throughs, there are area pharmacies, there are vaccination campaigns. Of course, you can go to your doctor's office if you want to be old-fashioned about it, but there are lots of ways to do that. Just a reminder, the nasal spray is not going to be recommended this year, should not be used this year, because it did not provide the level of protection that we thought it would do. We are recommending the regular flu vaccine. Remember, if it is your child's first time at getting a flu shot, they do recommend two shots, unfortunately. And I'm sorry about that. That seems like a cruel thing to do to a young child. But basically, everyone over age 6 months should get an influenza vaccine. Now, the other things you can do, just a reminder, as the flu season starts, wash your hands regularly. If for a moment you can take the viruses, the bacteria off your hands that you've acquired by touching surfaces, by shaking hands, then you may be able to prevent yourself from getting an infection. So washing your hands is an excellent idea. If you are sick, if you have a respiratory illness, please have some consideration for your coworkers. Work from home. Isolate yourself in some way. Don't spread illness at the workplace. That is not a good employee. That's not a team player.
No, that is not a team player at all. Hey, I got a question for you. Do you wash your hands before you eat?
Yeah.
Snack, whatever?
Sometimes it's hard, but I really try to do this. And you may be aware, my biggest pet peeve is the people that want to come up and shake your hand when they see you in the dining area or at a meeting. If I have a plate in front of me and you shake my hand, then what do I do? I got to leave and wash my hand.
Yep.
That's not good.
Have you ever seen a smoker wash their hands before they smoke? They probably should.
That's a good point. Yeah, well, certainly something that goes in your mouth. I mean, among all the other problems with it, and we've certainly railed against that in the show, but it's a good point.
Yeah.
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 Okay. Another way to
get the flu really sucked down in your lungs and make sure you get a good case of it.
Let's vaporize those viruses so that we can get them in quicker. But our sponsor for this segment and every segment of today's show, the Vaccination League, don't be late, vaccinate. Now, just a very brief history lesson. I am not a history expert, but I read stuff and I want to bring it to the show. At the 11th hour, the 11th day, the 11th month of 1918, World War I ended. At about 5 o'clock that morning, Germany signed an armistice agreement, and it took effect on November 11th at 11 a.m. World War I, 9 million soldiers dead. I think Vietnam War was 45,000 over a decade, essentially. 9 million soldiers dead, 21 million wounded. France, Great Britain, each lost nearly a million soldiers. In addition, 5 million civilians died from disease, starvation, exposure. This was the war to end all wars. And I'll just read from the source. I believe this was Wikipedia. Unfortunately, the peace treaty that officially ended the conflict, the Treaty of Versailles, I'm from Kentucky, please forgive me. The Treaty of Versailles, 1919, forced punitive terms on Germany that destabilized Europe and laid the groundwork for World War II. And after World War II, we learned that and we implemented the Marshall Plan to try to actually stabilize Europe so we wouldn't have World War III. Unfortunately, we tend to forget how sometimes economic measures and other things can prevent war and save lives just as effectively as a new weapon or a faster jet. We seem to spend more money on those things. So that's just a little bit about why we have... It was originally an Armistice Day, and then it's been expanded to include basically to honor veterans of all wars. The idea of Armistice Day, 1919, basically a year after the war ended, Sir Percy Fitzpatrick, he was a South African person, proposed a two-minute silence, which spread throughout the British Commonwealth and around the world. 1 minute. As a sign of respect for the people who died in the war, in this case World War I, the second minute for those who were left behind and suffered loss of someone they loved. And so we have done that, and we have now made it a Veterans Day to consider all wars, not just World War I, and it is at 11 o'clock on November 11th. What we remember, unfortunately, is that health problems go on, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. This was Healthcare Finance News. November 1st, soaring insulin prices prompt federal and state investigations into drug makers. Now, I will tell you, I spend a lot of time working at free clinics and talking to people who work at free clinics, and the two commonly used medications that give us fits are insulin for diabetes and inhalers for asthma and lung disease. These drugs, insulin has been around since 1922. We're now approaching 100 years of insulin, and yet the prices continue to be outrageous and actually are rising rather than falling after 100 years on the market, which is very frustrating. This was attorneys general in Washington, Minnesota, and New Mexico issued investigative demands this year from the insulin makers, and they're sharing information with Florida and California. What's happening on this, the price of insulin reaches record highs. The manufacturers, Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk, and Sanofi, raised prices more than 240% over the past decade to over $300 a vial.
And who else can get away with that? I mean, what else has gone up 240% in a decade?
Now, keep in mind, this insulin... For diabetics, it is not an optional drug. It's not like we have cheaper alternatives. If you are a type 1 diabetic, this is the difference between living and dying. Now, for a type 2 diabetic, sometimes it is the difference between being able to control your sugar and not being able to control your sugar.
And you know, the type 1s, there's a lot of kids. These are young people.
Yeah.
These are not older people who've done something, not taking care of themselves or whatever, if you wanted to make that argument. These are kids.
Yeah, high school, college kids who inject themselves with insulin, $300 a vial. As a matter of fact, then the insurance company, one of the insurance companies here they mentioned, took it off their preferred tier. They just said, gee, that's too much money. We're not going to support that fully with your insurance. And the price on that then was actually $487 a vial. compared with 200 a few years ago. And the this Healthcare Finance News report describes one college student who was trying to save money by going light on his insulin because, again, at those prices, college students don't have that kind of, well, none of us do, but the college students particularly.
Do you think the insulin pumps have anything to do with the price at all?
Well, the insulin pumps, of course, will be continuously infusing insulin, and they have enabled us to achieve a degree of control that we didn't have before. The market, I think, but pumps injectable, I think the market is there for type 1 diabetes. We have more type 1, by the way, that's the diabetes where your body just doesn't make any insulin. So you have to have insulin. There's no shortcuts. There's no way around this. You can't finesse this. You've got to have insulin. Type 2, you make some insulin, but you're resistant. Now, we have a variety of new medicines that have actually cut down on how much insulin we use for adults now with type 2 diabetes. But the type 1 diabetes, there's no other options. And for many people with type 2, they use it. And again, we're looking at you might need 2 vials a month.
Yeah, that's pretty common, I'd say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you're looking at then $600 to $800, $900 a month just for your insulin. Now you've got to buy the unfortunately the test strips for the finger stickers are not cheap. The syringes are pretty cheap, but and many people with diabetes have additional conditions. They got to buy other medications.
Yeah, I don't know any type 2 diabetic that just takes insulin.
Right. So there are others. So it's been rising more than 240%. The attorney generals are looking into this. The companies, of course, deny it. And it, for them, we've talked about this before, this is purely a business decision. This is not it's nothing personal. We can make this much money. We can sell the product for this amount. So why not? In the final months of 2007, Sanofi's Lantus insulin, a very common type of insulin used, $88 a vial. And Norvo, notice, Levemir, both of these are long-acting insulins. That was $90 a vial. Right now, the Lantus costs $307.20, Levemir $322.80. That's since 2007. That's over a period of 10 years. We went from basically $90 up to over $300. And I don't recall salaries continuing along that way. You've got here a business model. We can sell the insulin. We can increase the price. You've got the insurance company saying, well, if you increase the price, we're really not going to pay extra for it. We're going to change the dynamics of how it gets paid for. And you got patients that get caught in the middle. This is one of many drugs we've seen this happen to, and we have absolutely this investigation, they may find some collusion in these prices rising in lockstep, but if they don't, there is nothing they can do. We cannot control the prices of our medications, and it is, in my mind, the single biggest problem we have facing our healthcare system today is that we can't control prices, and particularly we can't control prices of medicine. So why not raise the price if you can get that much money, even if someone dies because of it? That's not your problem. It is our problem, and that's why we bring it to you on this radio show. One of the many things we're frustrated with. Well, we've got more frustrations in our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, sponsoring a Lung Health Awareness Fair 5 to 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, November 14th at the Center for Health, Education, and Research in Morehead. Information about lung cancer screenings and smoking cessation, refreshments, door prizes, and the public is invited. 5 to 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, November 14th. More information online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back to Health Matters. This is Shelley Irvin.
And I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is our Armistice Day show. We are, as I said, not necessarily celebrating, but remembering Veterans Day, as it originally was named Armistice Day, November 11th. And we thought we don't do a whole lot on this show for troops because we're a health show. But if we're going to air on November 11th, it's hard not to remember sacrifices of our military. The sponsor, our vaccination league, Don't Be Late Vaccinate. Avoid those harsh chemical vitamins and antibodies and do something natural with your body. Naturally stimulate your own immune system to take care of those viruses and bacteria with a vaccination, like Mother Nature with a 23-gauge needle. And we talked about flu season. Just a reminder, go get your flu vaccine now. If you want to wait till the program's over, that may be acceptable, but frankly, your time is running out, so if you want to go ahead, turn your radio off and go get vaccinated, we will understand. But there are some changes coming about, some simplification coming about in the vaccination schedule for adults. This was the CDC. They have an advisory committee on immunization practices. It's called the ACIP for obvious reasons. And they made a couple of recommendations. And one of them I wanted our radio fans to be aware of. We talked probably a couple of weeks ago about Shingrix. It's a new shingles vaccine. This vaccine is it's constituted differently from the old Zostavax shingles vaccine, and it has an adjuvant. The adjuvant makes your immune system respond more vigorously. That means that as opposed to about a 50-50 chance of preventing shingles nerve pain, it's got about a 90% chance of preventing shingles nerve pain. And shingles nerve pain is really, really annoying. It is a very bad condition to have. It also lasts longer than the old Zostavax. Now, the advisory committee says this vaccine is so good. Two things. One is we're recommending every adult over 50 get it. Now, before, the shingles vaccine had been given at age 60. Main reason, because it didn't last very long. And so we thought, all right, let's just hit that peak time. They're now saying, well, you should get one over age 50. They're saying this is the preferred vaccine. It was close because when you use the adjuvant, you also increase the rate of side effects. The shots hurt a little bit more likely to get arm swelling, joint aches, and a fever. But they have recommended it by a close vote. They recommend it over the old Zostavax. And here's the change, though. Their draft recommendations, which will be reviewed in February, are even if you have had the Zostavax, you go back and get the Shingrix vaccine. So even if you have had a shingles vaccine in the past, now that we have this new one, you go back and get the new one. It's two shots. It has an adjuvant. It is a very annoying vaccine to take. But the difference in protection is notable, measurable, and significant in the opinions of the committee.
Any recommended time period between getting the new shot if you've had the old shot?
First of all, the two shots are 8 weeks apart. And they said, let's see, it is I think it is 6 months after you've gotten the other.
Okay.
I'm sitting here looking at that, and I can't. I had it, and then I lost it.
You did have it?
No. Thanks for that. I'm sorry. 8 weeks apart, at least 8 weeks after the Zoster virus, the Zostavax, or 8 weeks after an episode of shingles. So wait 8 weeks, and then get two shots 8 weeks apart of this new Shingrix vaccine. So there it sits. It was right in front of me. My eyesight is vanishing. Well, thanks for pointing that out. Well, I think in the absence of Rick, Shelley feels a need to antagonize me. So thank you.
I'm obligated.
I understand. It's part of how the show works.
But no recommended boosters on the new?
You know, no, not right now. Right now it's just the two shots. But the problem with this, you know, first of all, if we vaccinate against chickenpox, we will create a generation of people and subsequent generations who don't even need this thing. This is a temporary fix to avoid shingles. Shingles is essentially a reactivation of chickenpox that you got when you were a kid. So if we grow a generation of Americans who were vaccinated and didn't get the chickenpox, they shouldn't get the shingles. Mm-hmm. But right now, because the shingles is common, we may wind up doing regular vaccination against shingles for our generation, and then the kids don't have to have this. But right now, it's a one and done or a two and done in the case of Shingrix. They only recommend a single session with two shots 8 weeks apart. Next up, this was from the United European Gastroenterology Week. This was a big conference in Europe, 2017. This thing was in October, and I saw this come on the news wires October 30th. Medscape Medical News reported this from Barcelona. Gastroenterologists coming to Barcelona. And I want to remind you, screening for colon cancer in the U.S., most of us use the colonoscopy, which removes the polyps that will become a colon cancer. Now, you can use both a test for blood and also a test for cancer DNA, where you use a sample of your stool and test for those things. The test for blood is pretty darn cheap. The test for the DNA is cheaper than a colonoscopy. But the problem with them is if they're positive, you need a colonoscopy. And so a lot of us just say, well, let's just get the colonoscopy. But it's supposed to start at age 50 and go to about age 75. One problem we've had is that there is a rise in cancer incidence, colon cancer incidence, and deaths from colon cancer in younger people.
We've talked about that before. Do you think diet has a lot to do with that?
Either diet or antibiotics. I am convinced that it is related to the germs you grow in your colon. There's a guy named David Carcenti, and he's from France, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce where he's from in France. But he says, like everybody else says, well, we usually start at 50 years, but he thinks we ought to drop the age to 45 years. They looked at 6,000 colonoscopies in a French referral center back in 2016. Average age of the people getting the colonoscopy was 57 years. The rate of detection of any polyp, 34%. And the rate of detection of cancer was around 3.6% of all colonoscopies. Now, if you look at it in five-year increments, you go to people under age 30, the rate of colon cancer was less than 1%. The polyp rates were very low. You were doing a lot of tests for no particular benefit. But they had 500 people who were 45 to 49 years old. Polyp detection rate, 26%. Again, 35% over 50, 26% 45 to 49. The cancer rate was 4%. The cancer rate is 5% over age 50. So you ask yourself, you know, if we started at 45, we're going to get 4% of them are going to show cancers. We wait till 50, 5% of them are going to show cancers, but we got some people in their 40s dying. Now, you could get colon cancer in your 30s with no particular risk factor, but that is so rare that we're going to be doing too many colonoscopies, wasting money, perhaps hurting people with colonoscopies and not picking up anything. But he makes a strong case for dropping it down to age 45. Now, the argument has been, well, even if there's a polyp there, we'll catch it at 50, we'll be okay. Mm-hmm. But if you're detecting cancers at 45, 5 years with a colon cancer is not really a good plan.
I think it's interesting that they recommend it whether you have any family history of polyps or not. You know, it would make sense if there was a strong history of polyps to do it younger, but that's not what they're recommending.
Yeah. There are some groups, if you have inflammatory bowel disease, a family history of polyps, a family history of early colon cancer, it's just 10 years younger than whoever else in your family was diagnosed. Mm-hmm. You start whatever age you have to start to make sure that whatever happened to your relatives does not happen to you. But these were people at average risk. And they had, I've got it here, a cancer rate of 1.1% if you were younger than 44, a cancer rate, again, of 4% starting at age 45 and then 5% starting at age 50. So there was a definite jump up before people reached age 50, and yet we screened at age 50. Right now, your insurance would not pay for it at 45 unless you had some symptoms. So we are not suggesting people act on this. But we want you to realize if you do have some symptoms, it is not 45, 47 is not too young to get that checked out. And symptoms we're talking about are a change in your bowel habits, blood in your stool, things like that. We need to lower our threshold for checking that out in the 40s. It's not like everything happens automatically on your 50th birthday.
Yeah, and these are colonoscopies, so they're biopsying what they're finding in the tissue. So this isn't going to be like the mammogram thing where we were finding things that weren't really bad and biopsying them when we didn't need to, or – you know, same thing with pap smears, you know. This is the real deal.
Yeah, and colon cancer taking both sexes is the second most common cause of cancer death behind lung cancer. It is ahead of breast cancer, which is mostly for women, and prostate cancer, which is exclusively for men. So, we're trying to keep you, again, the Shingrix vaccine may become our vaccine of choice, and we may revaccinate people who have had Zostavax. The colon cancer screening guidelines may change, but this is going to be something slow. Our job is to keep our Health Matters listeners, that's you, informed about what might be coming up in health. And also, then we want you to realize you can take advantage of these things if you do have some symptoms related to your colon, such as blood from your colon or a change in your bowel habits, and you're in your 40s. Do not assume that everything's okay.
Do you think insurance is covering that yet for people at 45?
With symptoms, yes. Screening, no. This just came out, and it's not even peer-reviewed. That is, it hasn't been published in a journal so that other people can look at it and try to figure out if they did something wrong. This guy just simply made this announcement, and everybody goes, And that's where we are right now. This could be important. Next up, from Wall Street Journal, October 12th, and a little bit delayed on this, but I thought this was interesting. We are not running as much as we used to. This is what they said, the Wall Street Journal: a decline in millennial participation has ended a 20-year rise in foot race participants. Millennials, these are the people born between 1981 and 1997, essentially the 80s and 90s was their birth years. They're a third of the workforce. They surpassed baby boomers as the largest living generation in the U.S. And if you haven't noticed this on TV and TV commercials and in the stores who they are selling to, they are no longer marketing things to us baby boomers. apparently, Mark Harmon and the NCIS people and Tom Selleck are not really the heartthrobs of today's generation. I don't understand it. I know none of our listeners do. But the high point of competitive running, 2013, 19 million people finished some type of foot race, a 5K, a 10K, or a marathon. The number of racers in 2014 dropped slightly. And then last year, 2016, there was a 9% drop, 9% drop in the total number of people who finished a competitive race. Millennials in 2015 made up 33% of foot race finishers, and that's down 2 percentage points from 2014, and there's been a continual decline. Between 2013 and 2015, the number of adults who run 50 or more times a year, now we're not talking about competitive racing now, just the ones who run for exercise, 50 or more times a year, basically once a week, dropped by 11%, 22% drop in those ages 18 to 24, 19% in those ages 25 to 34. So these young family, young parents in their 20s and 30s, around a 20% drop.
But it's hard to run when you're texting, I suppose.
It might be that the Wall Street Journal said, well, there are exercise boutiques now. You know, there are so many different programs, and you're doing yoga, and you're doing we talked about the Tough Mudders and you know, things like that in place of foot races. I think they've gotten bored with running. And it may be, you know, it is, you know, you just, if you think about it, the idea that you would spend hours out there just running and without any electronic devices or anything.
Thinking.
Yeah, would be kind of tough. But by the same token, it's also a kind of a boring way to exercise. Number of frequent runners dropped by 4% among those ages 35 to 44. So once you get up to our age, it's not. The color run participation, that's where they pelt you with paint and colors and things like that.
It's really fun to be on the paint side of that, by the way.
Dropped by about 200,000 since 2013. So from 975,000 to 780,000, a pretty big drop. It's still, I mean, we still got almost 50 million people run at least once in 2015. Now, I ran at least once in 2015.
What were you running from?
It was raining. Not competitive in any way. I got another thing here. This was October 23rd, Bloomberg news. Americans are retiring later, dying sooner.
That sounds bad.
Well, it's not, let's face it, it's not good for the Americans that are doing that. The retirement age is rising. You know, we were a pretty hard 65, you were eligible for Social Security, and then we've incentivized it so that perhaps if you stayed to age 67 or continued working to age 70, you would get more benefits, more monthly benefits. And so many people are doing that. There are a lot of people that are working longer because their retirement nest egg is not what they thought they were. But at any rate, it is a fact that people are retiring later. The problem is, and again, we found some additional data in October indicating that overall our health is declining and our life expectancy is declining. U.S. age-adjusted mortality rate, this is a measure of the number of deaths per year, rose 1.2% between 2014 and 2015. That's the first year-over-year increase since 2005 and only the second, greater than 1% since 1980. And back in 1980, one of the reasons why our death rate rose was HIV/AIDS.
Yeah.
Now it is not a single disease. You could argue that the overdose, drug overdoses, are playing a role, and they certainly are playing a major role. But even without drug overdoses, we would be close to a rise in death rates. We are not taking care of these chronic conditions as we used to. Obesity rates are rising, diabetes rates are rising, and so forth. And that's having overall an impact that's significant and probably more significant than the drug overdoses, although they're playing a big role as well.
And we talked a few weeks ago about how in Eastern Kentucky or Appalachia, we're even – our death rates, you know, we're dying even younger.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, bizarre thing, good news for our pension plans, right? And we're not going to be around to collect our pension plans.
Mm-hmm.
And here's this message from Health Matters. Why not just stick it to the man and stay alive and collect your pension just to spite our governor?
Yeah. Quit smoking just to live longer.
If you won't do it for the kids, do it for Governor Bevin just because they're working on all those pension things. Let's just use that pension money. Postponing retirement can make financial sense because extended careers make it possible to afford retirements that last past age 90. But, again, it looks like it's going to be disease-ridden and not quite as happy as they show it on TV. The key measure is whether one of the things they look at is activities of daily living. And one of the big ones is just get up, walk out of room, walk across the room, get up and get out of bed. Number of middle-aged Americans with activities of daily living limitation has jumped. 12.5% Americans at the current retirement age had a limitation in their 50s. That's up from 8.8% of people who are in their 60s at the time that they were measured. So essentially, over the past 10 years, the activity limitations have gone up around 4%. That's a pretty big change.
That is pretty big.
Death rates can be volatile from year to year, but they have not gone up like this before. Now, this is, like I said, it's not going to save our pension program. It doesn't mean that there's a mass die-off, but the trends are troubling. In this day and age, we should have the capability with the Affordable Care Act as it is, with people having universal insurance, with our healthcare system spending as much money as we are, we have the right to expect a stable or rising life expectancy, and in fact, we're not getting that. We're also not getting additional discussion on the air because it's time for a break. Why don't you take one? We'll take one. We'll come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, sponsoring a Lung Health Awareness Fair 5 to 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, November 14th at the Center for Health, Education, and Research in Moorhead. Information about lung cancer screenings and smoking cessation, refreshments, door prizes, and the public is invited. 5 to 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, November 14th. More information online at neahec.org.
Hello, welcome back to the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. We call this the Armistice Day Show. We are remembering our veterans. We are remembering those who died in World War I and in all wars. And also, as I mentioned, equally remembering those left behind. The holes in families, the holes in communities, the holes in society left by people who sacrificed their lives for our country. We owe them something.
Yes.
We owe the survivors something, and part of what we owe them, I think, is to try to settle our differences and make this country a country that was worth dying for. Of all the things, I hate to think of all the sacrifices these men and women made, our country not to be one that was worth that level of sacrifice.
Right, to be the kind of place that they sacrificed for it to be.
Yeah, I think so. Our sponsor for the final time of the Vaccination League, don't be late. Vaccinate. Remember to avoid those harsh chemical vitamins. They are made by chemical reactions, and they are packaged in plastic bottles and sent out. But you can avoid all that. You can use the all-natural immunization methods to train your body's immune system to protect you. That's right. This is the exciting part. Don't be late. Vaccinate. Vaccinate against those those viral and bacterial illnesses, and let your own immune system be in charge. It's like Mother Nature with a 23-gauge needle. Now, we talked about the advisory committee recommendations. The big one, the movement we see, is there is a new shingles vaccine called Shingrix. It has an adjuvant. The adjuvant stimulates your immune system. It means more fever, more muscle aches. It hurts more. But two Shingrix shots are substantially better than the old shingles vaccine, which was called Zostavax. To the point that the committee has recommended, their draft recommendation is, even if you had a shingles vaccine, even if you had Zostavax, go back and get this better one. It lasts longer. It's more protective. And they are recommending it for everybody over age 50. Current recommendations, current guidelines are vaccine for everyone over age 60. So there may be some changes coming out. The again, the CDC is going to look at these and issue a final report in February. But until then, I wanted to make our Health Matters fans aware of this. The other changes, one additional dose of mumps, measles, rubella administered to adults who previously got two doses. But if there is a mumps outbreak, and we've had problems with these, the vaccination immunity seems to wane a little bit. You're fine in your day-to-day activities, but if there is an outbreak, you could get caught up in that. So they're recommended, if we see an outbreak, get an additional mumps shot. And then the other thing had to do with the HPV vaccination. It turns out that series, you may be able to get by with two shots instead of three. And so it depends upon when you're vaccinated as to what you do. Again, these are recommendations from a committee. They are not the final guidelines. But there is some movement in our vaccines, and we expect to hear more about this as February approaches and they consider the final recommendations.
Have they changed the age for HPV? Have they extended it any?
I don't think so. I did not see that in this this summary. It is, 12 and up to 25.
12, yeah, 12 yeah. to 25.
But better to get it at a younger age. And again, we're sorry it does protect against cervical cancer. It also seems to be effective against oral cancer, and the rates of oral cancer are rising rapidly in young people because of different differences in the way that they have sex, just purely and simply. Mm-hmm. And you can argue that your kids shouldn't have sex, and that's great for you, but you can also protect your kids from getting cancer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So do it so you can scold your kids. Vaccinate them, and then you can annoy them for the rest of their long lives because you did vaccinate them. That's the HPV vaccine, and that's the Vaccination League. Don't be late. Vaccinate. And one final reminder, flu shots now. Turn the radio off. Get the car keys. Get out.
You're
get your
late.
Vaccination.
You need to catch up. Catch up now.
Yes, absolutely. This is our contemplative section of the show. I try to bring the more controversial stuff in, the things that would make you think. And I mentioned this. I said, all right, Shelley, you're going to have to think. You can't just sit there and criticize me like you've done the past two segments, even though Rick's not here. You're going to have
try.
To. Okay. You're going to have to actually think. This is October 25th, American College of Surgeons Clinical Congress 2017. It was in San Diego. This was Arun Nemani, who is a researcher at Rensselaer Polytechnic in Troy, New York, a very, very, what do you call it? It is an extremely advanced academic, basically engineering school. Yes. Mm-hmm. This is where Rensselaer is one of the best schools in the country. And they point out, here's the setup. Technical skills, obviously essential to the work of surgeons. They practice these on simulators, but when they do their board exams to see if they're still qualified to do surgery, and this is going to be a bigger and bigger issue as we have older surgeons, they just have to answer questions. So you take a guy, your life depends upon this guy or gal yes. being able to adequately take something out or sew something up, and we're going to ask them a series of questions to make sure they're still capable. Obviously a problem. One exception, American Board of Surgery requires candidates pass the fundamentals or laparoscopic skills test. If you're and also if you're going to do endoscopy, you're going to go look in your person's stomach or in their colon, you've got to pass the skills test too. And they rate the surgeons based on their speed and the number of errors. But it's hard to tell where the gold standard is. How? Because you're not trying to go as fast as possible when you're doing surgery.
Right.
You're trying to do as well as possible. They use something called functional near-infrared spectroscopy. Basically functional. Again, they are imaging your brain while you are doing something. Infrared probes on the outside of the head to measure the hemoglobin and regions of the brain involved in motor skills. In other words, the question this thing answers is, how hard are you thinking? How much blood is going to your brain? How hard are you working on this? They look at the motor cortex and the supplementary motor area. Some of these areas show more activity in experts. Some show more activity in novices. And it's been interesting because if they just they had a bunch of people who had never done surgery before, and they said, hey, here's a fun game. Why don't you do this laparoscopic skills? And if you're pretty good, I mean, if you've done a lot of World of Warcraft or you've flown a lot of simulator jets, you can probably do that, and you can do it pretty fast. And there's an overlap between medical students, novices, and skilled surgeons. But what they found was when they measured the blood flow, the surgeons who were skilled and expert did not have to think as hard as the gaming kids or as the medical students. And so they could sort them out better. There was only a 2.2% to a 2.7% overlap on the laparoscopic skills and an 8-9% on the virtual simulator, whereas there was a 14-20% overlap when you just measured speed and success. This is what they said. This test might be used to assess practicing surgeons as well as medical students. It can potentially be used to assess surgical motor skill decay. When surgeons return from active military duty, haven't practiced in some time, you can quantify exactly how hard they have to think, how their skills have dropped.
So it's kind of like a driving test.
But it's a driving test where they're peering into your brain. It's not necessarily did you park the car. It's how hard did you have to think to park the car. If you have to occupy most of your brain with this, you know, and then something goes wrong, you don't have any excess capability. You can't bring more thought processes to the battle. Whereas if you've done this time and time again and it's second nature to you, if something goes wrong, then you have the ability to concentrate. So it's sort of like I would, as a skilled person, I would have a reserve. The scary thing, though, is, I mean, imagine this. I'm a medical student. I want to be a surgeon. And I have worked and worked and worked, and I can't pass this test. I'm thinking too hard when I do the surgery. And they said, you know, you don't have any, you know, there's nothing in reserve for you.
Well, did they test that? Did they throw in some sort of confound in the middle of the exercise?
No. And they said this is a long way, but I see this. As a matter of fact, I've already told you we're going to look at another example here in just a minute. I see this becoming more common. I mean, first of all, we are absolutely obsessed with assessing everything.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what's happening in our school system? What are the teachers teaching? We need standardized tests. We need to compare them nationwide. All the teachers are teaching for the test. We can't have that. Now we've got to, you know, and just on and on. Every time we measure something, it changes. That's actually a principle of physics. If you measure something, you change the behavior of that. There's also something called the Hawthorne effect. When you look at something, it changes. Mm-hmm. And so as we measure, we change the behaviors to try to adapt to the measurements. And so I don't know what's going to happen to our brains, but I know that we will not be satisfied with the fact that a surgeon was good 5 years ago, or a surgeon has done 100 procedures. Mm-hmm. Our question is, how's he doing today?
Yeah. And like you said earlier, where's that cutoff? You know?
Yeah.
Any complication is one complication too many.
And maybe you would run some tests on me as a first year medical student and say, okay, you enjoy your education, pass all your tests, but you are not becoming a surgeon. Mm-hmm. A person with your brain activity has no chance of being a surgeon. You would just be a disaster.
Well, and it could be the surgeons that think the most, that use most of their brain, don't have the complications. So it might not be an issue.
They haven't compared it. What they did was they compared it with skill level.
Mm-hmm.
They compared a surgeon to a medical student to a video gamer.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. They haven't said, okay, here's the minimum you need to be a good surgeon, or here's these circumstances, or for this type of surgery, this type of brain pattern does better. They haven't done that. But they feel, and I've seen this before, that I saw it with multitasking, you know, when you're driving and trying to do math problems and text at the same time, you can see how your brain only has so much hemoglobin. It can only send blood to so many parts, and eventually your brain becomes overwhelmed. Multitasking is a bit of a misnomer. You can't be doing all those things simultaneously, even if you're ambidextrous or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, something to think about. And I'll pose the question to our audience. If, in fact, you do something with your hands, then we could design this test to see whether or not your brain is fit for it. And the question is, you know, what would we do with that? What would you feel comfortable doing with that? You know, I frankly, as I've gotten older, I like education, and I like to make sure I'm scheduled. I do not like forced evaluations. I don't think anybody does, because there's always that chance that someone's going to tell you you can't do what you want to do. Well, this kind
That's
of strikes
true.
Home.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Next up, very similar. This was Newsweek, October 30th. Marcel Just, psychologist at Carnegie Mellon, he is a guy that uses functional MRI scanning to identify what part of the brain is involved in thinking. A friend of his, David Brent, was a psychiatrist, attended one of his talks and said, did he think he could detect changes in the thoughts of people who are suicidal? Published October 30th in Human Nature Behavior, the answer is yeah. They can actually tell a difference in the brain activity of a person who is suicidal. 34 people, 17 had suicidal thoughts, 17 hadn't. They used functional MRI scanning. And it's the same idea. You image the brain, and you figure out where the blood flow is. Now, the other one, the surgical one, they measured, they used a spectrometer to figure out where hemoglobin in the blood was. In this case, they can actually measure the blood flow by imaging on MRI. They were shown a series of words that represented different concepts. Carefree, comfort, bliss.
Did they say it like that?
Yeah, I think they probably did. They showed them the word, so I guess you could pronounce it however. But how would you pronounce carefree?
Yeah, that's true.
You're not going to go, oh, carefree. You know, you're going to say carefree. It's got to go up, carefree like that. Then they had negative things, apathy, death, desperate. And you see the difference? I mean, right away you can see I'm not suicidal, right?
Right.
Not yet. and then that's related to suicide. And then there were some others which were negative but unrelated. Boredom, criticism. You notice how I broke up with criticism because cruelty. They were negative but not related to suicide. And then they looked at the brain signatures, MRI, the functional MRI scanning, when they said those things. In particular, there's a picture in Newsweek. It shows the brain activation pattern when they saw the word death in people who had made a suicide attempt and someone who hadn't. And truthfully, you can see a difference.
They made an attempt or they just had thoughts?
No, these people made a suicide attempt.
Okay.
And that wasn't clear in the Newsweek article. They said 17 who had suicidal thoughts. But then when they showed this MRI scan, this is a person who had – it's a summary, I think, of the participants who had made a suicide attempt. And so I think when they say suicidal thoughts, it's a little more than that. Then they trained a machine learning algorithm. Notice this machine said, all right, what's the difference, what's the difference, what's the difference? And it started compiling its own database of the differences between the two. And by the end of it, they could show this machine a brain scan of a person who is looking at the word death, and the machine could predict whether or not that person was suicidal.
Wow.
Now, I will tell you one of the big problems we have in medicine is we can't. We simply can't. We will ask a person, if a person's depressed, they will come into the emergency room, we'll ask them, have you thought about suicide? Mm-hmm. And they may or may not tell us the truth.
Right.
And the fact that they may have thought about it is not the same as carrying it out. And it seems to be, and this is my opinion, I think, and the opinion of some others, that the actual suicide is somewhat of a sudden thing. It's on top of a prolonged depression, but it is somewhat impulsive to actually finish it off. And in this case, this thing may be able to predict in advance.
Yeah, and in the what you read, they don't really have words that have to do with impulsivity. You know, no. That would be interesting to see.
Yeah,
you know.
And I don't know if some of these people are poets and they're mathematicians. Does a mathematician commit suicide the same way a poet does? I don't know.
Think what this would do for parenting. You know, if you could see how you talk to your kids, how it lit up their brains.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just look at when they roll their eyes, I sort of know, you know, what's going to happen there. But your point is, yeah, we could put some numbers on that and we could compare with other parents the brain scans of our kids. But meanwhile, it is time for us to get off the air, and we've got to do that without Rick's help, so we will try to wing it. Special thanks to our Moorhead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote that toe-tapping Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, it's WMKY.org, or visit us on Facebook, HM Radio Show. For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember these words delivered by General Omar Bradley on Armistice Day, 1948.
Democracy can withstand ideological attacks if democracy will provide earnestly and liberally for the welfare of its people. To defend democracy against attack, men must value freedom. And to value freedom, they must benefit by it in happier and more secure lives for their wives and their children.
Throughout this period of tension in which we live, the American people must demonstrate conclusively to all other peoples of the world that democracy not only guarantees man's human freedom, but that it guarantees his economic dignity and progress as well.
To practice freedom and make it work, we must cherish the individual. We must provide him or her the opportunity for reward and impress upon him or her the responsibilities a free person bears to the society in which they live.
We at Health Matters bring you this reminder from General Omar Bradley in 1948, which also rings true today. Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down. We must learn the lessons from history and dedicate ourselves to avoid repeating them. Today, let us remember the sacrifices of our veterans and chart a course where that sacrifice is no longer required.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.